maintain an interpretation of the prophecies of Daniel that does not employ the concept of the time gap? Can anybody, for that matter? Or must he also, at certain points, accept a gap, and thereby weaken one of his strongest objections to his third view? That's just a question, which becomes a rather important question, I think, in interpretation of some of these chapters that we will look at from here on. It's 5 after. Let's take a 10-minute break, and then we'll come back and start on Daniel 2 and 7. All right, number 3 on your outline is Daniel 2 and Daniel 7. Let me just look at my calendar here. We're, next Tuesday when we meet, the second hour, you will meet in groups. The two groups that were on that handout to formulate your arguments for whatever viewpoint you are defending. And then the second class next week, first hour, you'll present it. Second hour, you'll formulate responses. So, hope you're working on that. But, for now, Daniel 2 and Daniel 7. Daniel 2 is the first chapter in the book that contains a great deal of prediction. It contains that incident where the king has a dream, Nebuchadnezzar, and he forgets it. And then he asks his wise men to interpret it for him. And not only interpret it, but tell him what the dream was and interpret it. And if you look at verse 10, these wise men, the Chaldeans, say, "There's not a man upon the earth that can reveal the king's matter. Therefore, there is no king, lord, nor ruler that asks such things of any magician or astrologer or Chaldean. And it is a rare thing that the king require it. There's no other that can reveal it before the king except the gods whose dwelling is not with flesh." And for this cause, the king was angry and very furious, commanded to destroy all the wise men of Babylon. So he makes that request, and Daniel then asks the king for some time, and says that he will give him the interpretation of the dream. So you read in verse 19, "Then was the secret revealed unto Daniel in a night vision. Then Daniel blessed the God of heaven. Daniel answered and said, 'Blessed be the name of God forever and ever, for wisdom and might are his. He changeth the times and the seasons. He removeth kings, setteth up kings, giveth wisdom to the wise, knowledge to those who know understanding.'" And the secret then is revealed to Daniel. In verses 31 to 35, he tells the king the dream. He says, "Thou, O king, sawest, and behold a great image. This great image, whose brightness was excellent, stood before thee, and the form of it was terrible. This image's head was of fine gold, its breast and its arms of silver, its belly and its thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet part of iron, part of clay. Thou sawest until a stone was cut without hands, which smote the image upon its feet that were of iron and clay, and broke them to pieces. Then were the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, the gold broken to pieces together and became like chaff of the summer threshing floors. And the wind carried them away, that no place was found for them. And the stone that smote the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth." So you have in verses 31 to 35 the dream. And then in 36 to 45 you have the interpretation. 36, "This is the dream, and we will tell its interpretation before the king. Thou, O king, art a king of kings, for the God of heaven hath given thee a kingdom, power, and strength, and glory, and wherever the children of men dwell, the beasts of the field, the fowls of the heaven, hath he given into thine hand, and hath made thee ruler over them all. Thou art the head of gold. After thee shall rise another kingdom, inferior to thee, and another third kingdom of bronze, which shall bear rule over all the earth. And the fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron, for as much as iron breaketh in pieces and subdueth all things, and as iron that breaketh all these shall it break in pieces and bruise. And whereas thou sawest the feet and toes, part of potter's clay, part of iron, the kingdom shall be divided. But there shall be in it of the strength of the iron, for as much as thou sawest the iron mixed with miry clay. And as the toes of the feet were part of iron, part of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong, partly broken. And whereas thou sawest iron mixed with miry clay, they shall mingle themselves with the seed of men, but they shall not adhere one to another, even as iron is not mixed with clay. And in the days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. And the kingdom shall not be left to other people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. For as much as thou sawest that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it broke in pieces the iron and the bronze and the clay and the silver and the gold, the great God hath made known to the king what shall come to pass hereafter, and the dream is certain, the interpretation is sure. So, there is the interpretation. Now, it's clear in this vision or dream and its interpretation that you have four kingdoms. The parts of the image are a head of gold, breast and arms of silver, belly and thighs of bronze, legs and feet. The legs are iron, the feet are part iron, part clay. Question is, what do they depict? What are the political kingdoms that are symbolized here? And then, what is the stone that smashes the image and destroys it? Now again, there are three basic views as far as interpretation. Parts of the image, head of gold, breast and arm silver, belly and thighs bronze, legs, feet, legs are iron, feet part iron, part clay. Stone smites the image and destroys it. Question is, to what kingdoms do the parts of the image refer? What is represented by the stone? There are three different answers to those questions. First is that the climax, taking those three views we talked about a few minutes ago, first is the climax is in the time of Antiochus Epiphanes. This is the critical view. And advocates of that approach would say the climax is in the time of Antiochus Epiphanes. And that this vision is depicting the succession of kingdoms after Nebuchadnezzar until you get to Antiochus Epiphanes. So just like chapter 8 leads up to Antiochus Epiphanes, and chapter 11 leads up to Antiochus Epiphanes, so here in chapter 2, the stone cut without hands, which comes and hits, is a Jewish uprising that will gain deliverance from Antiochus. So that brings you into an area of prophecy. The prophecy is the Jews will destroy Antiochus and set up a kingdom that will fill the whole earth. Now, critical scholars would say that's what's in the mind of the one who wrote it. He's depicting history up to the time of Antiochus. He's really predicting the overthrow of Antiochus and the establishment of a kingdom that will fill the whole earth. Of course, we would know that whoever wrote this was mistaken, because the Jewish uprising maybe got rid of Antiochus, but they didn't establish a kingdom that filled the whole earth. So things didn't happen exactly as were expected. Now, look at page 42. In your citations. This is taken from Porteus. First three paragraphs are from page 46, and the last one from page 47. But here's the way he develops this view. He says, there is no doubt at all, as we have seen, about the identification of the first kingdom with the Neo-Babylonian Empire. The great majority of modern scholars, likewise, agree that the fourth kingdom is that of the Greeks. That this view is correct might be difficult to demonstrate on the basis of chapter 2 taken by itself. But when the parallel vision of chapter 7 and the visions of the concluding part of the book are taken into account, a case can be made out which would convince anyone who is not committed to another view in spite of the internal evidence of the book itself. Interesting statement. It is undoubtedly true that when men look back from the vantage point of early Christianity, they saw in the tremendous event of the founding of the church the fulfillment of the promised triumph of God's kingdom as it had been foreseen by Daniel. But all this should not prevent us from looking fairly and squarely at what the book itself said. This is page 42 in the citation. As we shall see, the evidence points unmistakably to a date which may be very closely determined within the reign of Antiochus Epiphanes for the completion of the book as we have it now, and makes it clear that the climax of history was regarded as being imminent at that particular time. That the expectation was not literally fulfilled is a fact which has to be honestly faced. Moving to page 47, he says, if the fourth kingdom is Greece, it is clear that the third kingdom must be Persia. And then there seems no choice but to regard the second kingdom as the apocryphal Median kingdom. See where there are fours. For the existence of which, between the Babylonian and Persian periods, there's absolutely no trace in contemporary records. The Median kingdom of actual history, which had played its part in destroying Nineveh in 612, was incorporated in the kingdom of Persia in 550 by Cyrus when he defeated the Stygians. It is only in the book of Daniel and in writings dependent upon it that we meet with the mysterious and baffling figure Darius the Mede, who owes his supposed existence to a historical blunder. Top page 43. We possess contemporary records, and they show that there's no place at all between the fall of Neo-Babylonian dynasty and the assumption of power by Cyrus the Persian for Median kingdom. Moving on to page 49. It signifies first that the fourth kingdom is to be a divided or composite kingdom. After the death of Alexander, the Greek Empire did break up. Eventually, the two successor kingdoms, which were of most consequence to the Jews, were the Seleucid power of the north and Ptolemaic of the south. By the second century, the former, that is, the Seleucid, had clearly, by the victory of Antiochus III, proved its superiority over its Ptolemaic rival at the Battle of Panaeus, 198 BC, so much so that Palestine had passed from the Ptolemaic into the Seleucid sphere of influence. We must therefore conclude that the iron represents the Seleucid kingdom and the clay the Ptolemaic. Secondly, however, the mixture of iron and clay is explained as symbolizing certain intermarriages between the Seleucid and Ptolemaic royal families, to which reference will have to be made later, see chapter 11. These intermarriages had not led to stable friendship between the houses thus linked together. Next paragraph from page 50. In his interpretation, Daniel finally comes to the mysterious stone, quarried without human agency, which strikes the image on the feet, its most vulnerable part, and in a moment reduces it to a heap of fragments, so small and light that they are all winnowed away by the wind. This is said to have happened in the days of those kings. By which is meant the kings of the fourth kingdom, not the kings of all four kingdoms. It is a result of the figure employed in the dream, namely an image, that the four kingdoms are represented as if they were all present contemporaneously and vanished at one and the same time. This should not be pressed. Chronological sequence clearly introduced in the interpretation. The grotesque growth of the stone in the dream is explained as meaning the establishment of an eternal kingdom. Jeffrey well says, its standing forever is the universality of the kingdom in time, just as the mountain filling the earth was its universality in space. It is not clear whether when we are told that the sovereignty of this kingdom is not to be left to another kingdom, there is any implication that the kingdom which is to be set up is that of Israel as the people of God. That may well have been in the writer's mind, but the thought is not expressed unambiguously until we come to chapter 7. That's basically the critical approach to Daniel chapter 2. The succession, you see, includes that apocryphal Median kingdom to give you the four before you get to the Greek. And then in the context of the Greek kingdom, the mixture of iron and clay is the intermarriages between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies. Okay. Question on that. Second view. Would find the climax at the first advent of Christ. Advocates of this view would say critical view is wrong. Antiochus comes in the third kingdom, not in the fourth. And advocates of this view would say that Antiochus doesn't appear in this chapter at all. He's not in view at all. He may be in chapter 8, chapter 11, but he has nothing to do with chapter 2. There's no mention of him, no reference to him. And the position would be that the head of gold is the Babylonian Empire, the breast and arms are the Medo-Persian Empire, belly and thighs are the Greek Empire, that's Alexander and his successors. The legs and feet are the Roman Empire. And then in the time of the Roman Empire, this stone cut without hands that smites the image appears, and that is Christ. And by the birth and life, death and resurrection of Christ, you have this decisive blow struck to human empires. And with his coming, a new kingdom was established that covers the whole earth. Look at page 45. Young is the representative here. Next to the last paragraph, bottom of 45, which is speaking of chapter 7. That first paragraph is of chapter 2. This comes from page 148. Should be noted that with regard to the fourth beast, Daniel sees not only certain characteristics, but also the unfolding of a history. In fact, within the history, it's the first paragraph there under Young, not the second. That second paragraph is chapter 7. The first paragraph is chapter 2. Most Christian expositors find the reference, and this comes from page 79, most Christian expositors find a reference in Christ and the progress of his kingdom. And this seems to me to be correct. The stone is represented as not being cut out of the mountain by hands in order to show that it is prepared not by men but by God. The blow which it delivers strikes the metals in the reverse order from which they had first been described, as if its effects would not only reach onward but backward on the remnants of former earthly greatness. The kingdom of God will completely triumph, and the kingdom of men, as represented by the image, will be completely destroyed. So, fulfilled at the first advent of Christ. Now, I think you can see that there'd be some reason for coming to that conclusion. You have a Babylonian Empire, then a Medo-Persian, then a Greek, then a Roman. The Babylonian, Persian, and Greek empires lasted 100, 200, 300 years, not enormous spans of time. Then you come to the Roman Empire, and in the early period of the Roman Empire, you have the coming of Christ. It might seem that if you're going to say this is the second advent of Christ, and you need to extend this Roman Empire in some way to not only the present, but future to our own time, that you kind of, Roman Empire is out of proportion with the others as far as time is concerned. But let me just pose some questions here before going on to the third view. We'll come back to this. When Daniel says in verse 35 of that stone, smites the image, and it says it became a great mountain, the last phrase of 35, and it filled the whole earth. What does that mean? Does that mean that the kingdom that is established here as the stone smites this image is to be found in the spiritual realm with the spread of the gospel? Or does it mean that in the spread of the gospel, the whole world eventually is going to become Christian? You see, that'd be a post-millennial view. It's not a view that we've been talking much about, but when we looked at the prophecies of Isaiah, we looked at that post-millennial view that would argue that those conditions of peace and justice will be realized here on earth in a very literal sense, but that will come about as the gospel is taken to the ends of the earth. So are you talking about, with this view, with the first advent, are you talking about a spiritual kind of kingdom? Or are you talking about a kingdom that we haven't seen yet, but that will be realized in the earthly physical sense eventually through the spread of the gospel? Or is fulfillment to be seen in connection with the second advent of Christ rather than the first? See, that's a question that can be asked. I'd say let's hold those questions for the moment. Let's go on to the third view, which would say the climax is with the second advent of Christ. The succession of empires would be the same as with the previous view, that is, Babylonian, Medo-Persian, Greek, but when you get to the legs and the feet, you have an added distinction. You have the Roman Empire, but with two phases. You have the legs and feet you have the legs of iron, and then you have its feet, part of iron and part of clay. And the suggestion would be that you have two phases there between the legs and the feet, and that there's a gap between the two. Now, see, if you look at that succession of empires, Babylonian Empire lasts about 80 years. The Persian Empire, about 200 years. Alexander's about 280 years, not his own rule, but the Hellenistic kingdom lasted till about 50 BC, so about 280 years. But then you come to this question of the Roman Empire, what do you do about it? Do you extend it 2,000 plus years? That's a long kingdom, and you can ask, where is it today? So that some have argued that there's a gap that occurs in this fourth kingdom between the legs and the feet. And that's indicated by the iron of the legs and the iron and the clay of the feet. Now that might seem artificial. And I think for the present we could say that we'll just hold this and see if some of the other prophecies of Daniel may throw some light on this.
Is there anybody that would believe that would separate that into five categories? It would just keep the legs of iron as the Roman Empire for 400 years, that the feet is something separate, iron and clay, it's distinguished from the bones.
It could be. I'm not, in commentaries I've read, I'm not familiar with someone that's labeled it that way. I think part of the problem with that it would be that so many times in Daniel, maybe not in this chapter, but so many times you've got these four kingdoms, and there seems to be a parallelism. You know, in chapter 8 there were four, chapter 7 there are four. Chapter 7 is quite parallel to 2. There are 4 and 7, you'd think there'd be 4 and 2. But then it could be a matter of degree, you see. If you're going to posit a gap here, in a sense you're speaking of a fifth kingdom, but not a fifth kingdom that has nothing to do with the one that precedes it. In other words, a fifth that in some sense traces its origins back to the fourth then, and there's a certain unity as well as this unit, continuity, discontinuity, if you want to use those terms. But I think the problem would be the parallelism is so striking between 7 and 2, and in 7, instead of an image, four parts, you've got four beasts, four different animals, but it's 4, it's not 5. And within the fourth, again, you get this horn that comes up. It seems like it's the Antichrist, quite clearly, in 7. So, question in 7 is of phases within the fourth kingdom, much like the question here is of phases within the fourth kingdom. There's another question.
I was just wondering about the horn's idea for the Catholic Church in relation to the way with the two phase idea.
Say that, whose idea is the Roman Catholic Church?
The Reformers.
Oh, the Reformers' idea. Well, it's not only the Reformers, but there have been a lot of people that have argued that modern Europe, Catholic Church, Western ideas of law, Western alliances, you know, NATO, all those kinds of things have been drawn into this continuation of the Roman Empire, one way or another. Let me go back over to, in the form of objections to the various approaches. That first viewpoint, the critical viewpoint, if you hold to that, you've got to get four kingdoms before Antiochus Epiphanes. And the only way to do that is to create that median kingdom and put it in between the Babylonian and the Persian, which is historically erroneous. So the result is, if you hold that position, you have an inaccurate resume of previous history. It's mistaken. Character as divine revelation is destroyed. With the second viewpoint, first advent of Christ, the Roman Empire only really became an empire at about 30 BC. So that the stone referring to Christ at his first coming is placed in the early days of the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire continued long after the death of Christ. You have the destruction of Jerusalem long after the death of Christ at the hands of the Romans. The Roman Empire in the West came to an end in 476 AD. So that's over 400 years subsequent to the coming of Christ. In the East, we really became more influenced by Greek culture and thought, and gradually was reduced to the area around Constantinople that was captured by the Turks in 1453 AD. So in the eastern part of the remnants of the Roman Empire was destroyed about 1453. And a question might be asked with that second viewpoint. Where is the second phase of the fourth kingdom? Where's the distinction between the legs of iron and the feet of iron and clay? How's that fit with the first advent of Christ early on in the Roman Empire, the smiting of the image. The third viewpoint, climax of the second advent, seems like there's too much time involved. Well over 2,000 years, or at least 2,000 years, and the suggestion of a gap may seem artificial. So I'd say, at this point, let's make no decision on conclusion for chapter 2. But before doing that, let's look at chapter 7. In many respects, parallels chapter 2. Look at chapter 7 independently of 2 initially. See what's clear in chapter 7. And then compare it with 2 to see what light it may throw on chapter 2 and what light 2 may throw on 7. See how they relate. And I think you can do that trying to be careful not to push passages into line with preconceived ideas or systems. Just look at 2. You look at it, you see there are certain problems with the various viewpoints. Leave an open mind on that. Go to 7. Let's look at 7 next and see what 7 has to say, and then if 7 throws any light on 2. I see our time's up. Before we go to 7, we'll stop here. Question or comment of these questions?
Sir, you said